Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Hello, everyone.
I'm not an American citizen, and I'm not employed by a socialist magazine, so I didn't have to watch the Democratic National Convention this week.
But you did anyway, right?
Well, I did actually catch up with the Bernie speech, and I watched the Obamas, both of them, for some reason. I'm not sure why I did that. It might be like Pavlovian instinct, you know, old sense memories from 2012. But aside from that, I didn't watch much of it, although I really felt like I lived inside it for a week, hearing constant updates, seeing 2-second clips and screenshots and takes on Twitter, and it was very difficult. It was very discouraging. It was very frustrating and sad and hurtful. Did you watch much of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I had to write about it, so I watched certainly a lot more of it than I would have liked. And I don't know, the thing that really gets me about this, you know, this was for me one of those weeks where every time you log on to Twitter, you just have that sinking feeling. I think next week, of course, is the RNC. And I don't know, it'll be frustrating and difficult to be on Twitter in a different way, given the kinds of people I follow. I'm sure it'll be an absolute freak show. I'm actually, you know, looking forward to writing about it in a way. But this past week, so difficult not to just have a lump in my stomach. Because what gets me about the atmosphere right now is, you know, it's not enough for people to believe that supporting the Democratic ticket is, you know, a necessary strategic thing to do right now. They have to pretend like this is all really good and exciting. And so before I wrote my piece, I was doing what I tend to do with something like this, which is, you know, I want to get a sense of what normie pundits are saying. And the just breathless tone of some of the punditry around the DNC, the fact that so much of it basically just sounds like sports commentary, the whole thing is evaluated as kind of a performance. The criterion that's being used is, was this a good performance?
New York Magazine had an article called Joe Biden and the Democrats Found Their Voice This Week. And it's articles like that, headlines like that, that make me feel like I'm going insane, literally. Like, what's it to me if the Democrats have settled on a marketing strategy?
Right. Did the boys on Madison Avenue do their job?
Nothing is for me. I'm Canadian. I have to keep reminding myself that it doesn't matter.
Well, but even if you're American, right, this isn't for you. And this isn't even being treated like this is for you if you're a regular American voter. I mean, I suppose that is sort of an implied pretense of all of this. But what gets me about this style of punditry is, yeah, as you say, it's about, was this an effective marketing strategy? There's kind of a subtext that's supposed to be about, you know, will ordinary people respond to this? But ordinary people are never given the chance to respond to a political event on their own terms. It's like the role of punditry, you know, they're the professional mediators to tell you whether you're supposed to like this or not.
There was that tweet by that idiot Mark Harris.
Oh, I don't think I saw it.
He was saying, and I'm paraphrasing, when will the extremely online left finally realize that the convention is not for them? Let it be soon.
Okay, yes, and I did see that.
I mean, I like that because it's like, okay, well, the extremely online left, they're on the internet. They're not living in the real world. Mm. Unlike Mark Harris, who lives in the Upper West Side and, is friends with Steven Spielberg.
Right. Well,
that's the real world.
The thing about that take that is incredible is, yeah, of course, you know, a national political convention is not for a niche political community or something like that. But you know what is the very definition of a niche insular political community? The media and the political class, consultants, the kinds of people who put on a convention like this, the kinds of people it is largely ultimately for, and the kinds of people who are always the first ones to tell you, you know, with a leaden tone in their prose, that this was brilliant. This is the best thing I've ever seen. Such gravitas, such grace.
I also can't get over this thing that people keep saying about how empathetic Joe Biden is because he suffered loss. You know, he knows what it means to suffer. He knows what it means to see death.
I suspect he doesn't know what it means to not have health insurance.
Like, what does that mean? I mean, people are saying, well, wouldn't it be great to have an empathetic commander-in-chief? And maybe it would be, but empathy is not the end goal in and of itself. Empathy is something that lubricates the process towards getting to the end goal.
Yeah, this is, you know, one manifestation of a phenomenon that I think has really been intensifying really for the past 20 or 30 years, which is the substitution of people's private personal experiences and qualities for their public commitments. I mean, the thing that comes to mind for me every time I hear somebody do that take about Joe Biden and empathy and loss is, where's the public empathy? This is a guy who says that he would veto universal health care during a plague. There is so much suffering in America right now, even more than usual. There's a national evictions crisis. There's record unemployment. Schools can't reopen. There's literally mass death. And apart from, you know, a few things designed to tick the empathy box, I don't think that was captured by anything in the Democratic National Convention. You know, instead, they're holding digital prayer circles for John McCain. They're wheeling out Colin Powell to tell you, to vote for Biden. They're wheeling out Kasich to tell you that, don't worry, Joe Biden's not going to actually do anything. The left is not going to push Joe Biden around. And I think it was right after Kasich, they brought out Michelle Obama to say, you all need to be excited. We need to be as excited as we were in 2008. And it's like the subtext of her speech being, you know, you progressives who are frustrated with this, you gotta be excited. Get into the spirit of things.
Michelle Obama at one point said, now I know that Joe Biden isn't a perfect candidate. And, you know, it's a bad sign when she has to say that in the convention speech.
Well, okay, actually, this gets to something else I wanted to talk about regarding all the punditry. A basic feature of this kind of punditry is that you talk about an event like this in a way that is almost kind of dehistoricized, and which I think to a large degree is removed from reality. So if you really want to talk about the Democratic nominee, you would have to acknowledge things like, you know, we now know that no less than Barack Obama said, if anyone can fuck this up, it's Joe. You know, we know that the very people who made Joe Biden's candidacy a thing have serious doubts about him and about his ability to win. We know Joe Biden is somebody with a history of lying brazenly and outrageously. We know that a woman who used to work for him made a very serious accusation that he assaulted her in the early 1990s. So all of these things were known about Joe Biden, and they were known by the very people who made his candidacy a thing. All of that context, which is just basic public context, I mean, granted, my reading of it, my rendering of it just now was a little more partisan than you'd, you know, expect from, you know, somebody writing for New York Magazine or something. But a lot of what I just said is known to journalists and is recognized by them. And all of that seems to be erased from the equation. The thing is just evaluated on the terms of it being a public spectacle. And that drives me crazy.
There's also that part where she talks about 2016 and says, well, maybe the barriers to get to the polls were too high. Maybe enthusiasm was too low. Maybe we thought we had it in the bag, but this time we have to know better. Like, it's all deferring this responsibility onto the voter for being just either too lazy or too ungrateful to have gone out there and voted for Hillary. And this time you would better, you know, you'd better do it right. There was this hectoring tone through everything of being like, well, if you idiots had voted last time,
that's
and
right.
Now you'd better vote this time, because if you don't vote, the republic is going to get destroyed and democracy is going to be taken away.
I mean, this has been a feature of all of the sort of mainstream liberal commentary since 2016, right? Which is the people failed the Democratic Party and not the other way around. Like, the people right. running the most finely greased and well-funded political machine in modern history, they don't really have any responsibility. You know, the people responsible are the, you know, single mothers in Milwaukee that wouldn't turn out to vote for Hillary Clinton or
Brooklyn podcasters.
right. But this is what's kind of behind so much of, as you put it, the hectoring tone, you know, that we've all seen on Twitter this week. And I think it's that hectoring tone and that, I don't know, this reflex of kind of performatively shaming anybody who isn't enthusiastic. I think that is what bothers me the most. And there's a couple things I want to read here. One is a public post on Facebook by Ben Burgess. He wrote, I don't mind saying that plugging up your nose, wearing rubber gloves, and voting for Sleepy Joe is an extremely unpleasant but necessary defensive tactic so that, e.g., Democrats instead of Republicans will be appointed to the National Labor Relations Board, and what's left of organized labor will get a reprieve. In fact, I agree with the calculation, but I'm extremely annoyed by people who deny that the gloves and nose plugs are necessary and who scold and finger wag about leftists being perfectionists. That's both an extremely dumb response, and since 99.9% of humans react badly to stuff like this, an extremely counterproductive one. Why not just be honest about how bad Biden is and make a strategic argument? So, I mean, I think that's a really good point. When has, you know, shaming people who are not, I mean, I think, first of all, most people that are upset about John Negroponte, you know, being platformed by the DNC or Colin Powell or whatever, most of them are probably still going to hold their nose and vote for Biden anyway. So the demand here isn't really about how you vote. It's about, you know, you have to give up your moral agency as a person. You just have to pretend that those things are actually not a problem. And there's a deeper problem with that. I'm not going to name the person who posted this because it wasn't a public post, but I thought it's a good insight. A lot of liberals finger wagging about only holding politicians accountable after the election, but I've yet to see a serious theory of what accountability looks like when you've already ceded 100% of your political leverage with your uncritical and unconditional support for politicians now. It's just really emblematic of how the liberal theory of change is just some culture-based nonsense where a couple trending hashtags or Instagram posts somehow translates to political change, which is genuinely laughable at the best of times, but is mostly just sickening in the face of an unprecedented global pandemic and a planet hurtling towards unsalvageable climate disaster. I think this is a great insight and really speaks to one of the big problems I have with the kind of atmosphere right now, which is exactly what it was in 2016. I got in trouble. Somebody was very mad at me because I was quote tweeting a report from the Wall Street Journal where the head of Biden's transition team was essentially saying, you know, the deficit's going to be so big because of the Trump tax cut and because of COVID, we're not going to have a lot of latitude or, you know, the cupboard's going to be bare. He said something like that. So this is one of several recent examples of Team Biden kind of quietly signaling that their platform commitments right now are they're not going to be honored. You know, a platform which obviously from a socialist, but I think even from just a kind of normie progressive lib view is really inadequate to the crisis being faced and to the situation at hand. Even the sort of more milquetoast stuff that they want to do is not even going to happen. I wrote earlier this week about how reporting in The Hill, anonymously citing Democratic congressional aides, reported that the public option, which is Biden's signature healthcare reform policy, they're probably not even going to try to, you know, push for that. Why? Because, well, it'll be too hard to pass because all these Democratic senators, if they take back the Senate and have the votes to pass it, that's going to be from senators in purple states, and they're not going to want to vote for the public option.
Right. If it's not Republican obstructionism, it's Joe Lieberman.
Right, right. Which is amazing because I think it was the journalist Andrew Perez who went through the campaign pledges of all of the competitive Senate races where these prospective purple state Democratic senators are running, and they're all running on a public option. So this is all to say, we won't be able to do the public option because if we take back the Senate, the people that are running on our ticket right now, running specifically on a pledge to do this, can't be expected to vote for it. It's incredible. So that was all very long-winded. But what I'm getting at here is this isn't ultimately about whether people vote for Biden-Harris or not. This is about getting people to give up even the faintest hint of their political agency. You're not even allowed to hold Biden-Harris accountable for what their own stated campaign pledges are. Like, that is no longer even a metric you're allowed to use. You can't even just politely say, so is Biden going to, you know, go to the mats for the public option or not? That's been what he's been saying for over a year. Can't even say that. And I think what really hit me this week is that Burgess makes a good point that it's bad strategy to shame people. When has that ever worked to get people to vote? You know, it doesn't work anyway. And he's right about that. But ultimately, I don't think this is about strategy. There are two ways you can interpret the Democratic National Convention this past week. One is it was a pretty absurd spectacle that platformed all these awful people. The Democratic nominee is a very, you know, is a deeply compromised figure who everybody knows, almost everybody, including some of his advisors, it would seem, know that, you know, it's risky for him to appear in public too much. He's got a lot of baggage, etc. But that's really difficult to acknowledge. It's very scary to think that they might blow this again, which, you know, that's how I felt this week. You know, that's what my article yesterday was about. I felt a horrible sense of deja vu watching this convention because when I watched the 2016 DNC, it was the first time it really hit me that Hillary Clinton could blow this. They really don't get it. This is a populist moment, and they're, you know, running the most beltway campaign ever. That's exactly how I felt watching the DNC this week. They could blow this because they were going all in on trying to get center-right, conservative, suburban voters. They're doing things that will demobilize key parts of the Democratic base that need to turn out. So it's a very precarious and frightening situation right now. People are anxious, and because it's such a difficult situation, such a bleak moment, it's a lot easier for people to just tell themselves, actually, this is all fine and good. Actually, it's really exciting. Joe Biden, you know, he could be the next FDR. And so to me, the subtext of a lot of these hectoring and shaming posts is really about stop intruding on the fantasy that I've retreated to get myself through this moment. And I suppose I'm mildly sympathetic to that impulse. It's a very scary time right now. There's an unprecedented global crisis. And what's standing between everyone and four more years of Donald Trump is Joe Biden. So I think the hectoring and shaming stuff is often, anyway, less about strategy than what gets you through the night.
It's about strategy insofar as it's what they can offer voters or what they will offer voters. They won't offer policy, but what they can offer is that they're not Donald Trump. And so you'd better be happy about that. That is the one strategy they're willing to offer. So many people were excited for some reason about the Elizabeth Warren speech where you saw the BLM letters spelled out in toy blocks behind her, like semi out of focus in the background. And seeing so many people excited about that, that's one of those things that makes you feel like you're going insane. Like, it's such an infantilizing gesture, and it's such a nothing gesture. And, you know, this is a convention where in the middle of all these uprisings, in the middle of this pandemic, there is that video tribute to John McCain. And I think, well, what if there was a video tribute to Black Lives Matter? And somebody would say to me in response to that, well, that's not going to win the moderates. That scares away as many people as it wins. But I'm not convinced that a John McCain tribute video wins one single person in the world, but it does turn off a lot of people. And a BLM video, I don't think it would turn off that many people who are inclined to vote Democrat, but it would energize the base. So what are we doing?
Yeah, I mean, during an unprecedented social uprising after the George Floyd murder, they not only, you know, had a tribute video to John McCain, they had the architect of Stop and Frisk given a primetime speaking slot. Meanwhile, the shout out to BLM is the letters BLM spelled out in children's blocks while Elizabeth Warren is speaking from a classroom on Zoom.
In one of the designated progressive speakers video. So it's like, if you don't like that, well, don't worry. She's one of the marginalized people. So even that infantilizing gesture isn't to be taken seriously. Anyway, we mentioned John McCain, and I'd actually like to travel back in time and reflect on a great statesman tonight. Perhaps the world would be a lot different if John McCain, war hero, had won in 2008. But unfortunately, great statesmen were out of fashion in 2008, and he also had the misfortune of picking a running mate who led him astray. That's the story told by the 2012 J. Roach drama, Game Change.
We need to create a dynamic moment in this campaign, or we're dead. If you are going to seriously consider the governor of Alaska, you have to call her now.
This is Sarah. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
CNN has it even with Obama.
We can really win this thing.
I'm not sure how much she knows about foreign policy.
You can actually see Russia from land here in Alaska.
Oh my God, what have we done?
You're telling me what to say, what to wear, how to talk. I am not your puppet.
I can't control her anymore.
So I confess, I'm glad we're finally doing this because we've had a lot of requests for it. And this is a Patreon episode, so I hope all the real Michael and us heads, the diehards, will appreciate this little bit of red meat. But so I must confess, this is probably the fourth time I've seen this.
Holy shit.
Embarrassed to say. and I'm not going to snap back at you for laughing at me because I deserve it. But the two of us actually have a funny history with this film because we first heard about it from one of the stars of it. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Oh, that's right. Well, when we were working at the Varsity newspaper, we had Woody Harrelson guest edit an issue, and he was talking about how he was, right after this, going to go make a movie where he played Steve Schmidt. So we were very excited about that. By the way, I'd just like to say Woody Harrelson, close personal friend of me and Luke, at least for a couple weeks in the year 2011.
Have we told that story on the pod?
I don't think we have.
You are unduly embarrassed by that story, because I think...
It sounds like name dropping.
Well,
it is.
The thing is, it's name dropping, and you're worried that we're going to wear the story out, but it is undeniably a great story. I mean, I invited Woody Harrelson to guest edit an issue of the Varsity, and he showed up in my office with Owen Wilson at one point when I was writing my farewell editorial. He wrote an incredible editorial for that issue about his environmental activism that was incredibly left-wing and anti-capitalist.
It was a great article, and I think we just kind of assumed that some publicist was going to write it for him, but
yeah.
No. And, you know, he would come to the office and he would say things like, oh, I'm working on my article, kind of feels like I'm preparing my essay, you know, for school. and we had a lot of heart.
We told him about Rob Ford, and then he went on the CBC the next day and talked all about Rob Ford.
Yeah. But okay, listen, I'll tell you my Woody Harrelson story. He came to the Varsity year-end party, and, you know, Woody Harrelson is exactly the man you think he is.
He's great. He's super fun.
Very nice. You know, I'd gone out, I'd left the party with somebody to go get pizza, and then we came back, and there's this little crowd of people outside the Varsity office with Woody Harrelson, and they're all passing around a joint, and the campus police come up, and they say, sir, you can't... Oh, it's Woody Harrelson. You know, the idea of catching Woody Harrelson smoking pot on campus, like, if you're going to catch somebody smoking pot, that's very funny. But then later on, we were up back at the party, and he was regaling the room with this story. And he was saying, yeah, the fuzz came up, so I had to swallow the roach. But by then, it was mostly stem. And then he looks at me, Academy Award nominee Woody Harrelson looks at me, and he says, it was kind of like wood swallowing wood, you know what I'm saying? So that's my story. Anyway, he's in this film as Steve Schmidt.
Woody's great in this movie. Julianne Moore is brilliant as Sarah
Incredible.
Palin.
Yeah,
I mean,
very good.
Blows the Tina Fey impression out of the water. She looks and sounds so much like Sarah Palin. I actually forgot what Sarah Palin looked like after watching this again, and I had to Google her to remind myself. Ed Harris is great as John McCain. That's not to say that this is not a film we're going to criticize, because watching it again, I mean, it's fun. It is about as highbrow as kind of normie political drama gets. But it is so, the dramatic stakes in it, and I'd completely forgotten about this, the dramatic stakes in it depend so heavily on you being invested in the mythos of John McCain, which I don't want to dwell too much on because we talked about it at length on our John McCain episode. But I thought, just to kind of get that on the table before we talk about the film, I wanted to read a little bit from an essay that we've probably mentioned before. It's a famous essay by the writer David Foster Wallace called Up Simba. It's not about the 2008 campaign. It's actually about the 2000 campaign, the primary campaign that McCain famously lost to George W. Bush. McCain and Bush, I feel like, being very well represented at this year's Democratic National Convention. But so, you know, David Foster Wallace is a writer that I think Will and I have somewhat complex feelings about. We were talking about that off mic before. This essay is something I used to like and respect a lot more than I do. Like Game Change, it's an essay that kind of takes for granted that politics is inherently interesting and high-minded and noble.
It's actually not that different in some respects from, like, the Alexandra Pelosi movies we watch, where, I mean,
yeah,
it's better than those. But Wallace spends so much time describing just the ins and outs of the tour bus, how the doors on the bus work, as if that's inherently interesting.
It is a politics, what a concept essay. And the thing that he's grappling with is whether, you know, the maverick, you know, honest politician John McCain can even survive in this, you know, this world of canned soundbites and, you know, politics being artifice. And as Foster Wallace explains in a note that appears before the actual essay, his mandate from Rolling Stone, where it was originally published, was, you know, they wanted somebody who was not a political journalist, which is not was not a bad idea. There's so many professional journalists who might write a piece like this, and you could predict every beat of it in advance. But it seems like David Foster Wallace thought that he needed to sound like a political journalist, so he wrote a very David Foster Wallace-y version of just something that, you know, I don't know, Mark Halpern or something might write. So I want to read the first paragraph of Up Simba, you know, the stakes of it very much being the same as those in Game Change. Can the maverick politician John McCain still be a maverick in this rough and tumble world? The essay doesn't consider, you know, it takes as axiomatic that John McCain is this maverick. And that is and has always been central to the John McCain mythos, which I think is captured very well in the first paragraph here. He writes, "All right, so now, yes, yes, more press attention for John S. McCain III, USN, POW, USC, GOP, 2000.com, the Rocky of politics, the McCain mutiny, the real McCain, the Straight Talk Express, internet fundraiser, media darling, Navy flyer, middle name Sydney, son of grandsons and admirals, a serious hard ass, a way right Republican senator from one of the most politically troglodytic states in the nation, a man who opposes Roe v. Wade, gun control, and funding for PBS, who supports the death penalty and defense buildups and constitutional amendments outlawing flag burning and making school prayer okay, who voted to convict at Clinton's impeachment trial twice, and who, starting sometime last fall, has become the greatest populist hope of American politics, who wants your vote but won't whore himself to get it, and wants you to vote for him because he won't whore, an anti-candidate. Who cares?" So, you know,
That prose is so, like, Tom Wolfish. I don't know. I don't like it anymore.
I don't want this whole thing to become a conversation about David Foster Wallace. We might even do an essay on him sometime, because he's someone both of us have read a lot of, and like I said, have kind of complicated feelings about. That Gonzo style, you know, in his defense, you know, it is sort of semi-ironic. It's partly expository. He's telling you all the different things people think about John McCain, you know, and he's doing it in a very, you know, stylized way. So
yeah, but my taste has changed since then. Now I just like a coherent argument.
I'm not saying I like it. And the essay goes on, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that he has, you know, he does think that there's a core of authenticity and a core of nobility to John McCain. Anyway, I think, you know, that's all very useful here for just kind of clearing the ground and laying out what the stakes of Game Change are. So this is a movie based on a book of the same name by the since disgraced Mark Halpern, who I've never read any of his books, but my understanding, you know, before the allegations against him, he was considered one of the more skillful and articulate chroniclers, weavers of official campaign narratives. He wrote several books in the vein of Game Change, and he was very good at getting people to talk to him, getting kind of inside tidbits on a campaign. And so the film is kind of promising to give you that in dramatized fashion.
It actually feels like the script just took, like, huge chunks of Mark Halpern prose and, like, split it up into dialogue between the characters. There's this one scene where they're on the Straight Talk Express halfway through, and I wrote out the dialogue. It goes like, "CNN has us even with Obama. Are you kidding? Hey, Gallup has us up by 5. She's giving us exactly what we needed. We've made more money in the last few days than we did all last month. I've never seen bigger crowds in my life. They love her. We could really win this thing." You know, it's that kind of script where people are, like, constantly spouting headlines and statistics and, you know, Wikipedia synopses at each other.
I want to know, before we get into the plot, which, I mean, we don't need to go too much into because people know this is such a well-worn story at this point, but, you know, I've seen this film too many times, and so I didn't enjoy it watching it again, you know, as much as I maybe enjoyed it in 2012 or 2013, whenever I first watched it. But, you know, what was the experience of watching it again like for you? Because you'd seen it before, right?
Yeah, I'd seen it once before. I saw it in a class, actually. I had a prof.
A J-school class?
Yeah, J-school class. I had a prof who was a TV critic who showed it to us. I think just because maybe he was busy that week, or, you know, he wanted to give us a pacifier. And so it was sort of pitched to us as being like, hey, you get to see this hyped HBO movie early. And movies like this, these HBO movies, like the ones that Peter Morgan writes, like The Special Relationship, their appeal is for like politics junkies who want to think that they've seen behind the scenes, and they like they're smart enough, like they know how the official narratives are crafted. And
yeah.
So stuff like that isn't really all that appealing to me anymore. It may once have been. I think it's a pretty hack movie. But yeah, as far as bad movies we watch on this podcast go, this one's pretty entertaining and well made. But as you alluded to earlier, the fact that it takes as a given that John McCain is this great statesman who was foiled because he made the bad decision of a running mate, but also because all of a sudden he found himself in this zeitgeist that for some reason, you know, for some inexplicable reason, who knows what's going on, it no longer has a place for great statesmen, and it's becoming more racist. And we don't quite know why that is. And we see a lot of clips of the media. They function as a kind of Greek chorus in this movie. We see a lot of clips of Wolf Blitzer saying, "It's an historic moment. John McCain has secured the nomination." And we see a lot of clips of Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. And maybe I'm watching this movie at a unique historic moment, but when both major political parties seem so out of touch with what's happening, and when the media seems so out of touch with what's happening, and when the mood of the country is what it is, with so much suffering and, you know, all of these protests, there's something very tunnel visioned about this movie. It's conceiving of politics as you have the political operators and you have the media, and these are the two sides of the equation.
And then you have a braying mob.
Yeah.
You have a braying mob on the Republican side, and then, you know, among liberals, you just have people who are in the thrall of a celebrity, which, I mean,
exactly
was accurate for 2008, to be fair.
And seeing it now in a moment when, you know, the United States' political institutions seem so hopelessly ossified, and when so much of actual political activity and so much actual political vitality is coming from the braying mob, I don't know, I'm less sympathetic to this movie than ever.
Your oldest son is proudly heading off to Iraq next week. Who do you see as the primary enemy at this point?
Radical Islamic extremists.
Can you be more specific?
The terrorists, who are hell-bent on destroying our nation.
Governor, do you know why we're in Iraq?
Because Saddam Hussein attacked us on 9/11.
No, Al-Qaeda attacked us on 9/11.
Not Saddam Hussein.
No, it was Al-Qaeda, and that's why we're in Afghanistan.
Do you know the primary differences between the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq?
Excuse us for a moment.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen it, I mean, this is a film, and you haven't guessed it from everything we've been saying, this is a film about the McCain campaign's decision, thanks to Steve Schmidt, now of the Lincoln Project, big friends of the show, and actually official sponsors of today's episode. he advised McCain to pick Palin, the calculation being that, you know, they were going to lose if they didn't do something to combat Obama's celebrity. So they had to do something kind of crazy. And McCain was somebody, you know, and this is accurate, McCain was somebody who the Republican base was never super crazy about. And so they had to do something to whip up excitement and shore up those people, which actually, not to drag things back to the DNC, but isn't it amazing how Republican politicians always seem, they always have to bend the knee to their base, whereas on the Democratic side, it's literally the exact opposite.
Yeah, I think the Democratic establishment would say that that's the design flaw in the Republican Party.
And yet, who is it that's been winning for 35, 40 years? We can leave that hanging. The question answers itself. But so the movie is basically the story of McCain picking Palin, and it hits all the, you know, the moments that you remember. So you get to see the famous Katie Couric interview. You get to see Palin being coached. When they realize, you know, they don't have time to vet her. So they realize that not only does she not know anything about foreign policy, she doesn't know what the Fed is. She doesn't know who the, you know, the antagonists were in the Second World War. She is somebody who is hopelessly unqualified for any kind of senior executive role, and who also is very lazy, you know, is unwilling to do, you know, the basic things to prepare for debates, etc., who makes really silly gaffes, like all the time she said Senator O'Biden during the vice presidential debate, and who the experience of being in the limelight turned into a a dangerous sort of pre-Madonna, which is something the film develops, and which I think is accurate given the trajectory Palin took after this.
As you'd expect, there's very little talk of policy in the movie. Whenever policy comes up, I think early on, Steve Schmidt is talking on the phone to McCain about how the surge is working and you're the only one who's brave enough to say it.
That's the thing. That's what establishes McCain as a maverick, is John McCain says what's right, not what's popular. And what's right, the thing that makes McCain a maverick, is we need to keep our boys in Iraq forever.
And then immediately following that is this series of scenes where they're talking about what should our vice presidential candidate represent. And, you know, they're weighing various options, Joe Lieberman, for example, and they're saying, well, you know, is this a maverick choice? Is this a country first choice? The base is skeptical of you. And if we have a VP pick who's pro-choice, 40% will be less likely to vote for you. You know, McCain, this great statesman, this great maverick, is constantly weighing, well, what's the most maverick choice I can make in this moment? You know, he's seen as being obsessed with how they talk about him on TV.
Well, and I want to say something about the maverick thing, because the movie, you know, it's always been a bit silly and always a bit of a contradiction. You know, you heard in the opening passage of the David Foster Wallace essay that McCain is a media darling, and then you also heard that he's this great populist hope. And usually those things do not really go together. In this film, at one point, he exclaims, oh, the press usually loves me. Why, you know, why don't they love me? But, you know, the film is also presenting him as a maverick. And the maverick thing that he's supposed to do, it, you know, it turns out at the end of the movie, the moral of the story is that the real maverick thing would have been for him to choose Joe Lieberman as his running mate. The maverick thing is do the bipartisan Aaron Sorkin wet dream thing of having a ticket that's like a joint Republican-Democratic ticket.
And words like the surge or abortion, they come up in this movie, but they only come up as words on a scoreboard.
I agree with what you're saying about that, although I sort of liked that scene where they're all sitting around and the pollsters are talking about his numbers and they're saying stuff like, you know, if you you're getting killed with women, sir. Like, if you lose with women by more than 5 points, you can't win. And what I like about this is this actually is how these people talk, and this is how they think. You know, the modern polling industry comes out of marketing. That's what polling was invented for. It was to sell people things. And that was its first real widespread use.
But the movie is fine with it. I mean, maybe I want every politics movie to just be sallow. But I don't think that's too much to ask either.
No. But what I'm saying is this is how political consultants think and talk for that reason. It's not how politics should be. And it's ultimately not how politics is, because you can't, like, if you're selling hamburgers or toothpaste or something, maybe you can divvy extremely diverse, non-monolithic demographics into these neat little kind of niches where, oh, this type of cheeseburger isn't selling well enough with Latino women who make $50,000 a year on average. Or, you know, maybe that applies to advertising and marketing. Politics is supposed to be about, you know, values. It's a little cheesy to put it like that, but I mean, it is supposed to be about what people want and what their needs are. And those aren't something you can just neatly divvy up into these little demographics. But that is how, you know, pollsters and a lot of political consultants and frankly, a lot of journalists think. I was reminded watching that scene of a really dumb article I saw in Politico this week, where the framing was all about, you know, the revelation that Ed Markey is killing Joe Kennedy among millennials. And the conceit of the article was like, you would think that young people would go absolutely crazy for this younger candidate, and they're not. Big head scratch. And I mean, the lesson there is not that this is some kind of anomaly. It's that people don't just look at politicians and say, you know, oh, hey, that guy is kind of like me. That's my guy.
How do you feel about that current that develops in the last third of the movie about how the braying mob on the Republican side is getting more racist? Because I feel like this movie, Game Change, sort of presents it as being like the weather. It's this inexplicable thing that's just sort of happening, and neither McCain nor anyone around him is able to account for it. They don't even necessarily link it to Sarah Palin herself, despite the fact that she's a harbinger of a turn.
Right. It's something that has just been, it's a Pandora's box that's just been opened sort of arbitrarily and accidentally. I mean, that's another problem with the mythos of John McCain, is that he's this great moderate or something. It's like John McCain was, I mean, Foster Wallace refers to him correctly at the beginning of that essay as, you know, a quintessential right-wing figure. And I think, interestingly, in 2000, John McCain's reputation was that he was a populist. And yet in this movie, Ed Harris, as John McCain, very gravely says, there's a dark side to American populism, you know? And yeah, I completely agree with you about how the movie presents that. These guys like Steve Schmidt, you know, the real Steve Schmidt, McCain himself, John Kasich, Colin Powell, the kinds of Republicans that Democrats really like now. Bill Kristol, another good example. Bill Kristol, who is essentially, I mean, he's kind of just, he might as well be a liberal now. He apparently advised McCain to pick Palin. He was one of the conservative voices saying this is a good idea. All of these people are so dumbfounded that the Republican base...
That there's gambling in this establishment.
Right, right. Yeah. That the Republican base is like this. As if they haven't gotten to the White House. As if every single time they've gotten to the White House, you know, since Richard Nixon at least, has not been on the back of this very constituency. As if people that are professional, you know, beltway-friendly Republican consultants haven't made a point of weaponizing this particular constituency and all of the racism and cultural revanchism that motivates it. I think back to that quote from the guy who worked for Reagan, where he's talking about how, you know, in a way where he's almost complaining about how, you know, you used to be able to say the N-word and you can't do that anymore. So now you say Chicago welfare queens, you know, it means the same thing. I mean, just all these politicians and consultants who were perfectly fine with doing dog whistle politics for decades, all of a sudden couldn't control it anymore, you know, or they couldn't control it 100% and, you know, keep it in line, keep it disciplined. And it created an inconvenience for them. I think that is what really bugged them about Sarah Palin. And what's so incredible is that the end of this process that you see a stage of in the movie was Donald Trump. And the objection that so many of these people have to Donald Trump, just like the objection that I think guys like Steve Schmidt had to Sarah Palin, was that they were no longer able to control this, right? Why is Bill Kristol, you know, now doing, you know, joint appearances with Neera Tanden? Is it because he really objects to Trump ideologically? I don't think so. It's because when 2016 arrived, those people all discovered that this constituency that they had spent decades building up and putting at the center of American politics and using to pull American politics in the direction of further cultural revanchism, pulling everything to the right more and more, that actually it had kind of cannibalized them. And they weren't the leaders of the so-called conservative movement insofar as such a thing exists. Every prominent conservative movement leader, quote unquote, imaginable, contributed to that issue of the National Review, the Never Trump issue, Republicans against Trump. A huge number of those people have since fallen in line and they're now, you know, his biggest partisans. But at the time, and this is what matters here, no one cares. You know, people that watch Fox News, the actual, you know, radicalized suburban constituency that is how Republicans win elections, they don't care what Bill Kristol has to say. They don't care about the National Review and William F. Buckley. They don't care about David French. They don't care about Bill Kristol. They don't care about David Brooks. They don't care about Ross Douthat. You know, the conservative intelligentsia and the professional political class that was trying to make a guy like Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio, the Republican nominee in 2016, Republican voters don't care about these people. And in fact, mostly they hate them. I mean, one of the reasons Donald Trump was so successful is because he was able to just openly flaunt these people, openly defy them, openly mock them. But so this is one of the things that I think has aged very poorly about the movie. And what makes its sort of dramatic stakes, which were already kind of a joke in 2012, so utterly laughable now, is supposed to feel so bad for these guys like Steve Schmidt that they can't control this thing that they are in large part responsible for elevating and creating. Play me the world's smallest violin. You know, God, if only John McCain had picked Joe Lieberman. This movie is Joe Lieberman lives on my street, you know, for Never Trump conservatives and MSNBC libs.
My name is Sarah Palin. You all know me. Vice President nominee of the GOP. Gonna need your vote in the next election. Can I get a what from the senior section? McCain got experience. McCain got style. But don't let him freak you out when he tries to smile, because that smile be creepy. But when I'm VP, all the leaders.
Watching this movie, I was reminded of the Tina Fey impression of Sarah Palin that took America by storm back in 2008. And I also remembered, even though it's not featured in the movie, that a couple weeks before the election, there was a segment on Weekend Update where Amy Poehler did a rap about Sarah Palin, and she did it in the presence of Sarah Palin herself. You know, this was pretty standard operating procedure on Saturday Night Live at the time. They used to call them sneaker uppers, which is the kind of sketch where the person you're imitating sneaks up behind you and surprises you on air, you know? And that shows that, oh, you know, it's all in good fun. And then, you know, the politician you're impersonating can then, like, say the catchphrase that you've been saying to your face. They used to do this on the Royal Canadian Air Force all the time. Like, you know, when Stockwell Day would sneak up behind whoever was, like, impersonating Stockwell Day and say, reform!
Yeah, they've got a comedian is going like, oh, hello, I'm Stockwell Day. And then Stockwell Day comes up behind them. Devastating.
And of course, I immediately went and looked up that Amy Poehler rap where she's rapping about Sarah Palin, and she's almost doing this kind of like proto girl boss rap. Sarah Palin is sitting there at the desk, like vibing along to it, you know, showing that she has a sense of humor and can take a joke about herself. And, you know, people give SNL such a hard time, rightly so, for letting Trump host in 2015. But when that Amy Poehler rap aired, like, I remember watching it live and just being like, oh, yeah, this is how it works. You know, it's election season. Just as if a movie star has a movie to promote, they come on SNL. So, too, would politicians from both major political parties come on SNL and do a little skit with the cast. And it's funny, too, when you remember that the Tina Fey impression has gone down in history as being this, like, almost like era-defining impression, this piece of political satire that may very well have even swung the election slightly in Barack Obama's favor. SNL was still this institution that was dedicated to being nonpartisan and playing both sides of the fence and giving equal airtime right up about until Trump won.
Yeah, and actually this speaks to something that we talked about on our recent Master of Disguise episode, which I think was our last Patreon episode.
Such a good movie.
You could say the same thing about the Tina Fey impression, you know, as you could about Dana Carvey's HW impression. Whatever its merits might have been, the overall package was one of credulity, where, okay, you famously eviscerate Sarah Palin, but then, you know, she just comes on the show and you rap about her.
Yeah, because it's about positioning somebody as, like, kind of dumb, like maybe even lovably dumb, instead of what they actually are, which is evil.
Thank you. night.